What is up, SBL? It's Ian Martin Allison coming to you to talk to you about this event that SBL put on in mid-July. July 15, 16, and 17, we did an online summit called Base Space 2022. Was it the most mind-blowing thing that I've ever been a part of? Maybe. I got an opportunity to spend time with and interview and learn from so many of my base heroes. It's like overwhelming. There was Richard Bona. There was John Patitucci, Tony Levin. There was Chuck Rainey, Blue de Tiger, Gail Ann Dorsey, Cole Davis, Nick Campbell, Billy Sheehan, Divinity Rocks. I mean, just the list goes on and on, and there are even so many more than that. Oteil Burbridge, he's another one that comes to mind. Just an unbelievable experience that I dare say was life-changing. And here's the deal. If you're like, well, you know, I don't know. Is it really that great? I'm going to show you what I thought was one of my most favorite interviews of the entire event. So check it out. Without further ado, I present to you my interview with Tony Levin. I absolutely died. This is one of my favorite things ever. Check it out. I am here with the incomparable Tony Levin, and I'm trying not to freak out as I am a giant fan. You know Tony from his unmistakably signature work with Peter Gabriel, King Crimson, John Lennon, Paul Simon. I'm going to keep going with these names. David Bowie, James Taylor, Carly Simon, The Stickmen, Pink Floyd, yes, The Liquid Tension Experiment, and that is just scratching the surface. To me, Tony is the epitome of walking that tightrope act of playing for the song, supportive and foundational, while at the same time playing a line with a sound that in many cases defines the song, providing a bass hook, as it were, where the song would simply not be the same at all without Tony's contribution. It's incredibly rare. And we are incredibly fortunate to hear from you today, Mr. Tony Levin. Welcome to Base Space 22.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And I appreciate all those kind comments. I made a note. Never in my life have I heard this phrase, Stickmen, Pink Floyd. We link a lot of our band, but we don't usually get mentioned in the same sentence as Pink Floyd. And now it has
That's
happened.
Right.
You see, if you keep at it long enough, you get everything you dream of.
Oh, I love it. I love it very much. I mean, I feel like you are often thought of as this incredible hybrid between this creative player where you're doing your own things and then this side musician. And I heard the great John Myung of Dream Theater once say that when he's in the studio, he'll often think to himself, what would Tony Levin do? And I know that he's not alone, as I've thought the same thing. I mean, and I wonder if you could speak to your studio process a bit, how you prepare for a session and how you're writing bass lines, if you're writing them in advance or you just reacting to the moment, just a combination of things. I'd love for you to speak to that a bit.
Thanks. It won't surprise you to hear that I don't think about any of that stuff. I just play the music. But I have been interviewed before and I've been asked about how I do bass parts. And so consequently, I've thought a little about it after the fact. I don't have a speech prepared. Basically, not surprisingly, I'm a fan of music. And if I love the music that I'm playing, and I almost always do, I try to devise in my head, in some part, in my musical sense, a bass sound and a part that'll help that piece, that'll work with that. And that could be vastly different in different situations. But what's common is that I've learned, as I thought about what is it that I do, I don't come in with an idea. I don't come in with a riff. Or if I've been practicing, let's say the Chapman stick and have a really cool thing, I could wait 10 years before I get a chance to use that, unless it's my writing or Stickman, you know, unless I put it in a piece.
Sure.
I don't intrude into, I don't feel the desire to put into it whatever it is that I'm up to. And once in a while it works out that I can, whatever, what I'm up to will work for the piece. But more often I'm just trying to make the piece right.
Was that part of the process, when you're working with those iconic artists, do you find that they have direct bass ideas for you, or they're hearing melodies and they wonder what it would sound like on the bass?
Oh, sometimes more Paul almost in every case, but Peter Gabriel, whom I worked with, 3 days ago in England.
Yes.
He doesn't really sing the part, but often he just likes what I did. And sometimes he'll give me a sense, or he'll say, you know what? I like what you remember what you did 2 years ago and something. And I'll say, no, we'll look up the tape. or he'll play me a synth based part that he wrote. He often does synth parts, and we'll meld. Hopefully on a good day, we'll find the best of the best. And that's not always cool. The case with Peter. I could tell you stories all day and waste many hours. But there was one piece called Big Time where I came up with what I thought was a pretty cool idea of having Jerry Marotta drum on the bass strings while I fingered.
Legendary.
Legendary. Well, yes. To me it is. And record comes out, and that's the introduction, and it's cool. And then it's Peter playing the synth bass part that he liked that I never even heard before that. Okay, fine. Playing live.
Sure.
I have a synth set up with his sound, and I have my bass. Woo, I get to play my... And the tour goes on 6 months, a year, and I kind of play more and more of it with the funk fingers on my part. And Peter's way too busy running, flying out in the audience and stuff like that to notice. And then somebody, maybe his manager, comes to a show and tells him. And the next day, this front of house engineer said, Peter would like you to go back to playing the synth part more. And I do for a few shows. I think the extreme of that is not that piece, but way back at the beginning, maybe not the first tour, the second tour, he did a piece, I think, called Waiting for the Big One, where Peter did some radical things. Nobody had seen a radio mic at all. And the band would start a slow blues, and Peter would be in the middle of the audience. They wouldn't know that. And suddenly a spotlight would go on Peter in the middle of the audience, and he would start playing, and they were just shocked. They didn't grab him. They couldn't believe it. And he slowly would kind of croon and walk to the stage during the whole piece. So we did that for many tours for a long time. And one day, Jerry Marotta, the drummer, and I changed places, and Jerry started playing bass on the piece, and I was playing drums because it was an easy part. And we did that for quite a while. Manager told Peter, because he was way too busy to notice. He was being, mobbed. It was easy for him until he got near the stage, and they didn't want him to come back on stage. And you know what he said? His first reaction was, it wasn't don't do that. It was, oh, can I play drums when I get to the stage? So after that, he's fine with me playing the drum. He'd get to the stage, and I'd hand him the drumsticks, and he'd play drums for the rest of the piece.
I mean, that really comes across seeing the shows, listening to the music, that there is this sense of adventure and a sense of really boundless rules. Like, there are no fences necessarily, but just ideas, and why not try the idea? I've heard you say in an interview too that in the early days when you would pull out a stick, maybe on some other session, you'd almost get wrist slapped. Like, there might be a producer that would say, like, no, man, like, put that away. But I sense in you, just from talking to you for 15 minutes now, I sense in you this sort of tenacity to create and innovate. Like, you're talking about, the thing that you did with the funk fingers, you want to pull that back into the show, maybe as Peter is off doing his own thing. What made you not think that the stick was a quote unquote dumb idea, right? You had tenacity around it. You wanted to bring it in. People would say no, but you continued to say yes. And I wonder why.
That story is true. And that was from Peter Gabriel's first record. The wonderful producer, Bob Ezrin. I came with my various tools and instruments. In those days, it was a Fender Precision, and that's it. There were no funk fingers or anything. Maybe a pick and a finger. And I had the stick, and I opened it, and he took one look at it and said, close that thing. I don't even want to see it. Don't even leave the case open. And I was gratified when many, many years later, when I was playing on a Pink Floyd album, that Bob was the producer. When he asked me, he said, just the introduction and first verse of this I want on the stick. And then bass later, which is a very Pink Floyd, thing. It's not enough to just play bass on it. No, let's fine tune it and really have it be exactly wondrous and special. And so it was quite a few years before Bob came around and wanted me to play the stick.
But don't you think, though, that Bob came around because of your tenacity? I mean, if you would have said, sure, no problem, and put it away and not ever played it again, because you ended up playing it on Shock the Monkey, right? I mean, you ended up playing it on later Peter records, didn't you?
Yeah, well, Peter loved it. It was Bob who was producing that record, and the producer, well, they had other things to work out besides that. Maybe Peter would have fought for it in a later year. I think Peter would have said, let's hear it first. But it was Peter's first solo album, and he was behaving. I'm not that tenacious a guy. Peter's a tenacious guy. Peter would be still fighting to have the stick on an album if he wanted it.
Well, sure. In that first record, too, the first solo record, there's probably a lot of pressure on it, right? Coming out of Genesis, the producer, there's probably a lot of pressure, right? And sometimes pressure creates fear, you know, and you think like, well, we really need this to be serious. We don't want to try that experimental, weird, multi-string thing in the case. We need to go straight down the middle, play that P bass. You know, was it coming from that space, do you think?
I really don't know. I think I'll think about that. But I think for Peter, it was not only his first solo album and his new record label, and maybe the first time working one-on-one with a producer. And Bob is a producer who really knows what he wants. And it's, hey, I brought in my team. It's going to be this way. And then one of his team brought in something weird. That'd be me. And by the way, Larry Fast was on those sessions, playing amazing stuff on synthesizer and unusual things. And they were doing unusual things in that realm of it. I think the percussionist was hooked up to MIDI. MIDI didn't exist then, but somehow it wasn't that it was, we're making a record like other records, but there wasn't room for that instrument on that. Thanks for being knowledgeable about it and even caring about it. Oh. I had left it way behind me.
Oh, I care so much. Well, and I'm so curious too around the Chapman stick, just for you, what drew you to want to play that thing and what made you feel like you wanted to bring it to sessions? I mean, there was something about you where you're like, oh, this is an instrument I believe in. I mean, you've been playing it a very long time. And what about that thing was just irresistible to you?
Good question. The year it came out, Emma Chapman had been playing it before that, but the year it might have been close to 76, 75 or so. I hope I'm not awfully wrong on that. But I was, in those days, I was playing a lot of record sessions, and I was doing something I don't do anymore. I noodled. I practiced a lot during the session at the expense of other people's ears and stuff. I wasn't obnoxious, I think. I like to think. But what I did was a finger tap on the bass. So the same week, about three or four guys said, hey, there's a new instrument coming. Did you hear about this new instrument that's made for playing like that? I hadn't heard about it. And so consequently, when I was next in LA, I don't remember why I was in LA, I kind of made an appointment to try to see Emmett. Emmett was out of town, but one of his assistants or students or something was there. And I tried it in person. I said, all right, I could kind of use for this. And then I got it. What I didn't know I knew when I tried it out, is it's not just a touch guitar. The bass strings are strung backward and in fifths. So it's very different. Right. And I thought, okay, I can deal with that. And soon after that, I was touring with Peter Gabriel, and I had a chance to really learn it from the ground up. Like I picked the simplest song, which I hadn't played the stick on the album. I picked the simplest song and just kind of learned the tuning and the way it is. And I found it just really then and subsequently, I found it really ideal for what? For being progressive, for not having the same old bass sound. Not on any song. Yeah. It's very percussive for me. Other people could do a wonderful ballad on it or something, but for me, I wouldn't play it on a... Well, anyway, it's very percussive, and it speaks down low. It speaks incredibly clearly. So I could play very fast on a low D below the low E and have it completely be clear. It doesn't interfere with the drums. I didn't just use the stick because it's the stick. I used it for parts. What's the Peter Gabriel song you mentioned that I played it on? Don't Give Up, maybe?
Shock the Monkey.
Yeah. Utilizing the huge jumps that you can do easily on it because it's in fifths and because it only takes one finger to play a low note and one to play a high note. So nothing I did on the stick was technically difficult for many, many years. All technically easy, including Elephant Talk, the kind of signature stick part at the beginning, because it's at the beginning of the piece, the King Crimson piece, Elephant Talk. I just detuned a string to make it really easy to play with cross string. So I found it from then on, not the record to bring in sorry, not the instrument to bring in for a Pink Floyd song. However, I was wrong about that. But I found it very useful if I'm trying to be progressive and stretch this music into different directions.
Yes. And to me, it seems like you've always really prioritized. I mean, there's a lot of things about your playing that I hear you prioritize, but one of them is attack. Like, attack sound to you is really important, whether you're playing sledgehammer, right? Like with a pick,
yeah,
fretless octave divider, that thing, or funk fingers. That's a sound of attack, right? Or like a strike, that either, you know, two-handed tapping strike thing. For me, it was hearing that voice again, and there's like a beautiful stereo spread of stick parts in that. Well, I think so anyway. I think that's what I'm hearing. Maybe I'm not.
I don't know.
But to me, what it did, Tony, is it filled me with wonder. I would hear the sound, like you talk about the dong, that like real intense strike sound that you get out of tapping a stick. Almost sounded like a synthesizer, or it felt like it was leaning in the direction of almost key bass. Mm-hmm. And to me, I was just like, wow, what is that? Because yes, it is not a P bass with flats, right? It is very, it's something new and it's something innovative, and it still is. I still think, you know, when I hear stick, I still think it sounds progressive in the true sense of the word. Yeah. I got to ask you about a Stingray. I know in terms of bass guitar, if we go back to bass guitar for a moment, you're definitely known as a Stingray guy. And there was this period in the 90s, of course, when everybody's switching to fives and sixes. There's even, oh my gosh, man, there's a seven string, you know, all these multi, you know, the string basses are just, the necks are getting wider, the strings are multiplying. But you went the other direction. I mean, I'll never forget it, man. In the mail, I get that copy of Bass Player magazine that's got you with the three string, you know? I mean, the legendary three string that they built for you. And I'm so curious, what was behind that collaboration with you and Ernie Ball?
It's a long one and a very good one. I'm very lucky. I think they're great, of course. The instruments, I feel like these instruments, and by the way, let me say how I appreciate it. You clearly know more about my playing than I know. I'm just doing it. But you're mentioning stuff and I'm thinking, yeah, maybe he's right. That could, yeah. And I mentioned before, I forget it. I mentioned before, when I hear the song, if I'm doing a record, I imagine the sound and the notes. The sound is what you're talking about. You're talking about a part of the sound.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I just hear musically. And then I go about trying to do it with whatever instrument or whatever stuff is around to make that
like
sound.
Like the sound is here for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Musical. Yeah. You know, like singing, but my voice isn't that good. So some kind of, you know, so if I can approximate that, like one could say, I hear a piece and I think, well, a big thumpy woofy sound with a slow attack and no sustain at all. Just boom, boom, you know, or I'm saying boom, boom. Then I'll go about, well, look at what I've got and try to know my tools, know my instruments and what they can do.
Yeah.
And once in a while, I'm pushed usually by somebody else to do something like the funk fingers, which is essentially Peter Gabriel's idea. And that leaves me not remembering exactly what you asked. But I do appreciate your knowledge about these parts.
I think of you as, you know, you're innovative in the space. And when everyone was doing a thing, right, you maybe zag in a different direction, and it's not to maybe necessarily be different, but it's to, you're hearing something different. And so that when you show up on that cover of Bass Player magazine with a three string Stingray,
oh, that's right,
when everybody is going six string, why and how did that come about with Ernie Ball?
Well, okay, this time I'll remember what you asked. And the three string was, I asked them if they would do that for me. And it was, let's face it, it was a statement about not something different than the six string.
Yes.
And I think the magazine had asked me a few times to do an interview and I wasn't interested in that. I just didn't want to talk about myself. And I thought, well, with this, I can do it. And I actually prepared a whole bunch of statements of answers to the question, why three strings? Because that's why they call it a bass, because G strings are for strippers. They weren't great answers, but I had this, and that was integral with playing the instrument. By the way, it also had I wanted it to have no volume or tone controls. Easy for me to say. I don't know how they make the basses. And they said, well, it's got to be there. We could put it so there's no knob for you to turn, but it's part of the electronics of the bass. I said, oh, yeah. I didn't know that. So I had it. So,
great. You know,
plug it in. It's on. None of us has ever turned. No one I know has turned the volume down on a bass. Okay, here's my sound. Wait a minute. Yeah. Give you a little less of that. So I thought, you know, I was,
yes.
I guess I was right. Being self-indulgent, and my friend, mostly Sterling Ball, but also Dudley Gimple, one of the designers, they were very happy to indulge me. This is the word, indulge me. And they did with that bass, which I played. Interestingly, the strings were a little further apart than normal, so I could play easier with the funk fingers.
Yeah.
But it was, as you can imagine, the least versatile bass that I could bring. If I can bring one sure. bass, it's not going to be that, because I can't play a high note. And
sure.
I can't play a low note. It doesn't go below E. Great bass, though. And thanks for noticing it and for remembering it and for reminding me of it.
Well, I mean, it was just such a statement. I mean, that was in such a fertile time for me. And I know for Scott, too. Scott and I are exactly the same age. We're both 43. And I remember, you know, early 90s was me in middle school devouring. I mean, that was such a golden era, at least for me, of bass players. I mean, Flea, you, Les Claypool, Victor Wooten, right? All these just monsters of the instrument. Mm-hmm. And I know that other eras have that, too. But that was really my era. And so when I'm pulled in these directions of multi-string basses, more knobs, more, and you show up on the cover with a three-string, it makes me go, wait a minute. It was quite a statement. And I mean, it made a huge impact on me. I thought like, oh, so it doesn't mean that necessarily.
Good. I'm feeling great,
man,
about
it. It was amazing.
Even if one person was influenced by it, that's interesting.
Oh, it was huge. Huh. Because, you know, everything was more, bigger, more strings, more.
Yes. And, yeah. And I nowadays mostly play five string because it's got the fifth string and I need it. In my opinion, for me, and I'll go back and talk at length about the Ernie Ball Music Man Company, whom I've been close with for a long time. To me, that there's this gift that each bass gives you of that. That's what we want. If we're playing rock, you want the low E.
Yeah.
I don't know the words, but you know what I mean. And producers want it, and artists want it, and listeners want it. And the bass, some basses have it, and some don't.
Right.
And if it doesn't have it, I don't care how fluid it is up high and how even, because mostly I play rock stuff. I'm not being funny.
Right.
But mostly I play rock stuff.
No,
and
right.
I play,
it's great.
Maybe not E, maybe it's a G. But So in my opinion, when I switched from four string to five string, it was reluctantly because for some reason that E string on the five never sounded exactly. Music Man tried really hard and they got it really close, but maybe not even sounded, maybe felt, but it's just not the same. And it's really good and it's really funky. And there's obviously all kinds of other benefits I have. So I made the move.
Yeah.
And for that reason, and that reason alone, I didn't really want to try a six string. Because I was pretty sure the E string is not going to sound like the four string. You know, it's not that even though I may have had the three string, it's not that I value less. It's just that's very precious. It's a very, very precious thing about some basses. And I, having been blessed with a lot of basses with that, I don't really want to be without it and show up at a rock, even a gig, rock gig, and play G, 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 G. And it's thinking, I wish I had the Music Man, the string right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I played Fender Precision only when I was in New York, and I'm talking the earth had cooled, but it was a long time ago. And I was doing okay and doing a lot of sessions, some rock, but some just sessions. And I had a very good friend, Joel DeBartolo, an excellent bass player who lived in L.A. He's passed away since. And he was associated with Leo Fender in making this new Music Man bass. And Joel kept calling me, said, you got to try it. And I'm like, you know, the Fender really works for me, Joel. I don't need it. And he said, it's kind of the same, but it's got more lows and more highs. And I said, I don't want more highs. I got the high up with a one control. I got it up full.
Yeah.
To me, that was like, but I could use more low. So when I got it, which was 1980, because one of the first things I did with it was go to the John Lennon sessions that were going on, and bless it, wow. It had, not only did it have more lows to be thumpier if I wanted it, by the way, in a way that when I first came to New York and did sessions, the engineers would not have liked, and they wouldn't have accepted it. Back in the 70s, all the engineers who were in charge of the sound at every session, they wanted a Fender. It could be a jazz, but preferably a precision. Yes. And if you just came in with a Gibson or something with a lot of lows, they would say, don't get this bass player again. It's just wrong.
Wow, yeah. Right.
So, but so that it's consequential. Changed. Yeah. By that, by 80, it sure had long changed, because generally engineers were boosting the lows a little bit on my sound. And I was aware of that. So it not only had that extra low end, it had extra high end that I didn't need and still don't. But it's great to have it there if you want it.
Sure.
But it had built-in dampers. Now, it's a long and I don't need to tell you the history of dampers, which Leo Fender thought should be on every bass, and every bass player would buy a bass and then throw away the dampers. Sorry, Leo, we don't want it.
Right.
So this had them again, but they were screw type. Many years later, Music Man stopped that because of a lawsuit, and many years later, they brought it back, and I love those things. I still have them. Any bass I have that has them, they're on at least a little, even just a tiny bit.
Really?
Yeah.
You use them?
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Probably there would be times that I take them off. But anyway, a few years later, I think it was 84, I'm not too good at years, that Ernie Ball Company, the string company, bought Music Man. And instead of doing horrible things to it, like, we'll fix the bass, instead of trying to fix something that's not broken, they left it as it was. And with Dudley Gimple and Sterling Ball, they designed subtle changes that really helped it. And it got to be, in my opinion, better and certainly more versatile. And I could, they added, for instance, when they added a mid-range control, I hadn't known that I needed that. So the first thing I did was, well, how can I get it to sound like it's not there? And I turned it down and nothing changed. It was the same bass. But should I want some mid-range? And things have changed. But the way it was in live shows back then, arenas and big, and I was touring with Peter Gabriel and with King Crimson by then. Often the bass was just too boomy in the arena. And I learned that a little mid-range, which is not the sound I want on the record, but a little mid-range and a little less low would help me. Since then, front of house engineers have a lot more control over things and a lot more experience at balancing the hall and getting rid of the woofs and stuff like that. But that's the way it was back then. So I found the mid-range live to be the most useful tool I had had on a bass in a long time.
Mm. Bumping that mid-range up a bit, maybe not. Are you still diming the bass control all the way up, turning that thing all the way up, and then also just boosting some mid-range?
No, maybe on the old ones, because they've added more and more bass. Now, you know, it's an insane amount of bass. And the last one I got, the Stingray Special, is lighter weight. And again, I said, I don't care about lighter weight. And it sounds the same, and it's lighter weight. It's fantastic. In shows, it's just as good in shows. It's the same. But rehearsals, having a lighter weight bass rocks, because I don't love rehearsals anyway. And just the weight of the thing as the hours go by becomes more. So that's gone. Those days are gone. So bless them for keeping what's good about it and making subtle changes that make it better.
Well, and I mean, to me, when I hear a Stingray, it sounds like Tony Levin. I mean, or vice versa. I feel like that sound, it's such a signature sound. And you have also, of course, such a signature sound. And they've sort of meshed. When I hear that Stingray, the sound of like fretting a note on a Stingray, it sounds like Tony.
Well, thank you.
And it's very cool that you've committed to that for so long. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a very cool thing. I'm sure you've played other basses, but it's cool to me to see you stick with something for so long. It speaks a lot of how much you like that brand and that instrument.
That's true. And I do have and have tried other basses. And for some special uses, certainly the NS Electric Upright, I play a lot. Yes. So even though I have a Music Man fretless, they sound completely different. And I play the Music Man fretless plenty. But it's really worked for me because of the sound, not because I have loyalty to the company. I love the company and I love the guys there, but that's not why. You know, we're musicians. We really go with what helps us with our music.
Yeah. The sound here that you're dying to get out here. Yeah. And the tool that can help you do that.
The tool.
I mean, we've talked to a lot about, yeah, we've talked a lot about attack sound, right? And we, you know, and the Music Man, and you know, you're really excited about getting the right percussive attack, whether it's stick, whether it's funk fingers pick, but also Tony, I mean, you're a master of leaving space in your bass lines that draw attention to what you end up playing, because there's this stark, beautiful contrast, right, between the notes that you're playing and then the negative space of the rests. And that is something that is so clear. And I'm curious if you think about that. And what I want to know is, were you always so tasteful and intentional about rests and space? Or was there a period for you that you played too much? And was there some sort of painful reckoning that you had around, like, you're playing too much, you need to leave more space? Or how did your concept of tacit, wow, of rests, of space evolve?
You're pushing me, man. You're complimenting me way for the rest of the year. I don't want another compliment. Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, you're way past.
I'll try to tear you down a little after this.
Yeah. We're over my limit. My wife's not going to be able to live with me tonight. Hey, it's me. I have all this stuff. Let me play you the tape. I forget what it is, but it's I'm really cool. Let me play you the tape.
Let me show you.
Yeah. It certainly wasn't a plan. And if I think about it, that came from, like everything about my playing, came from listening to other bass players. So I realized a few years ago, only a few years ago, the tremendous influence that Oscar Pettiford had in me, a jazz bass player.
Yeah.
My older brother, yes, Pete, is a jazz player and was when we were kids. And his first, your older brother gets records before you can. So this combo that we listened to on many different records, but the same bass player and drummer and French horn player, Julius Watkins. And Oscar Pettiford, I wasn't thinking about it at the time, but just I grew up listening to this guy who played, in my opinion now, the right notes and only the right notes in a very tasteful way. And just only maybe 8 years ago, listening, when my brother and I said, hey, let's form a band and play that kind of music, the cool jazz of '50s, and let's write some new pieces. And we went back and listened a little bit to it, but we realized that we both remembered it, every note of it, partly because the songs were short. They were 2-3 minutes, and one guy would solo on the verse, and another guy would solo on the chorus, another solo, and then it's over. Two minutes, 3 minutes, it's over.
Wow.
But anyway, listening to it, I had the thought, unknowingly, I'm trying to play rock like he played jazz. I'm trying to play really the right notes, and if they're right enough, no more neat notes are needed. And he's not the only one. Of course, I love the way we bass players seem to listen to music different than other people. We always know on some level what the bass player is doing on every record. So going through my many years and all the listening I've done, not that I was studying it, not that I had the expertise of Scott's bass lessons, and I admire how you guys have quantified it and can show us and can play, but somehow in a much slower way, I was learning about those notes from, Paul McCartney included, later date.
Yes.
And what have I done that isn't trying to in some way, bring back a little bit of what he did, which is what melodic, when it works, when it fits, and just out of the way when it doesn't, never overplaying, being the songwriter, and I think he was the songwriter on a lot of those pieces. Okay, you're going to gravitate to that, but I'm not the songwriter, but I'm a fan of the songwriter and the song, and so it wasn't a conscious effort, and it wasn't something I invented. Came from listening to a lot of bass players in that style.
Well, I love and hate that answer. I was hoping you'd have. was hoping you'd say, "Oh, I got my butt kicked at this session, and the guy, you know, took my bass away from me." But of course, right? You came up listening to things you love to emulate. You had an older brother that helped you form your taste, and it's very cool. Just trying to emulate the greats.
Yeah. Well, let me say on that subject something that may be of more use to listening bass players than anything I say about myself. there have been times the bass was never physically taken away from me, But I have never been not wanted for playing too much, playing too many notes, of course. Not of course, but that's not my first instinct.
Sure.
But I have done plenty of sessions through the years where it didn't work out, where they didn't want what it is that I do or that I can do. And I think the reason that's a valuable piece of information for people earlier in their career, well, everyone's earlier in their career than me, but yeah, starting a career, there seems to be a degree of rejection and disappointment built into being a musician. And if that's going to happen to you, it might be helpful, a little helpful, to know that somebody as successful, quote unquote, as me, or any of the guys I've worked with, every single one of them, it's the same. And I'm not talking about the beginning of our career. I'm talking about it happens. It just happens for a lot of reasons. Only one of them is that you couldn't do the music and you didn't do it right. and that that could have been my fault at some time, but many more times it's just for one reason or other. And again, you probably know this, but when you play a little bass part for somebody on a record, you're giving them what you're giving them is more than the notes. It's a little something of yourself. It's a little something of, what defines you to yourself. So being rejected for that it can be hard. It can really be personal because it's like you're being rejected. So know that happens to us all. And I have no advice for how to bounce back on your feet and get past it. Others are better at that maybe than I am, but we've all had to face that, and you will too if you're a bass player. I'm sorry to tell you. Sorry to be the one to bring
definitely.
That in.
Definitely. Part of the process.
Yeah. Unless it's your band.
Right. And then when you leave that band, then you try to play with another band and they say, hold on a minute.
Probably there are guys who have been kicked out of their own band. Actually, they definitely are. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Well, speaking of another band, let me paint you this picture. It's 1991. I'm in my bedroom in middle school and I'm listening to this lovely record called Union by Yes. And I am falling in love with Chris Squire's bass lines and sound. And then years later, come to find out, oh my God, what? It's Tony Levin. I would just wonder what it was like to step into that legendary camp. And did you feel like you needed to step into Chris's shoes, or did you feel freedom to do your own thing?
Interesting question. Very interesting band to be in and to be not replacing, but instead of one of the greats. And by the way, Close to the Edge, the bass line, when you think about it, it defines what you said that it is that I do. Talk about leaving space. It's first, it's very busy and very distinctive. It is the piece. And then the second section, it's kind of very little. And that makes the first part better, doesn't it? To me.
Right.
Like,
yes.
That kind of makes the whole thing like a symphony. So great admiration for him. And it wasn't tense for me because I was a good friend of Bill Bruford and we were tight no matter what was going to happen. And I was there, able to be there in the recording. And then there's doing the recording, I just played like me. I didn't really think about trying to emulate him. But live, when we started doing the Yes material, I had to face a situation that I was to be in a lot later in my career with King Crimson when we started doing the classic material.
Of course.
How do I approach that? So my approach then, and as recently as last December when we finished touring with King Crimson, my approach was to try to keep what's iconic about the bass part, not to just be I can't beat that stuff. It's just too good. John Wetton's stuff.
Sure. And,
to try to keep what's iconic about it, but to still be myself. And that's not so easy. And that doesn't happen for me. That's not so easy. Maybe for someone else it would be. It doesn't happen at the first rehearsal or the 10th rehearsal or the 10th gig. It's kind of a process in the case of King Crimson for years. In the case of Union or Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe, I only did maybe two tours with them. And I kept working on it. I kept just trying to be myself. I thought about, should I practice with the pick? I actually took a month to practice before the tour. Or should I take these funk fingers, which are kind of new, and I haven't played anything anywhere near as technically challenging as Chris's parts. And I decided to try to up my game with the funk fingers, right or wrong. I did that. I just thought that would be more of a useful a better use of that month for me personally, musically, than to try to get better at a pick. And in the end, you know, being not any better than not as good as a whole bunch of other bass players. You know, let me just go where I can go with this. So that meant changing some of the fingerings and the notes. I couldn't just bash out all the notes with it, even when I got better with the funk fingers. But that was my opinion. But an interesting subject, because in King Crimson, I felt very taken and very, much in that process. I embraced it.
Yeah.
And I didn't judge it at all, and I didn't judge myself for doing it, but trying to stay true to what's special about those parts, but not put myself in it, but be myself musically with them.
Well, yeah, and there's something too, because if you have a voice on the instrument, which of course you do, you don't necessarily want to just ape somebody else's thing and in their shoes just try to do their thing, because no matter how good you are, you're never going to sound like that person. So I love this idea. When I was hearing what I thought was Chris Squire on that Union record, I was like, man, this pick sound is ferocious. Like I could have waited forever, you know, those tunes, Shock to the System, but it's you with funk fingers.
Well, thank you.
Oh, it's so wonderful.
I think that's an interesting subject because every bass player would take a different approach to it. There is no, this is the way to do it. And my trying to be me, not trying, my letting myself be me is different than you letting yourself be you. It's going to be different.
Yeah. Yeah.
When we had the first rehearsal for the live tour, this is the only kind of tour there is, for the tour, it was in Pennsylvania, in Pennsylvania, Dutch country, and we were in a barn, and, you know, I did this stuff with the funk. We got through, and we were on a break, and I went out to the, I don't know, the field behind the barn. It's kind of a country place. And there were about four cars with bass players who had heard about the rehearsals, and they were out there listening, and they had brought their Rickenbackers. I thought, this is good. You know, if I have a heart attack, we're covered. That's one thing. But the second thing is they were clearly noting that I hadn't played a Rickenbacker with a pick. And I was kind of shrugged. And it was an interesting moment.
Oh, that is great. You see, I mean, against all odds, I love it. You're honoring the parts, but you're swimming upstream slightly, which I think is, because you're paving your own way. You want to honor that thing the part that needs to be played. Tell me that there's some video out there of you playing Roundabout with funk fingers.
I don't know about video, and that's the only tour that I couldn't finish because I got sick. I got hepatitis during the tour. So the video they made at the end, they brought Jeff Berlin in, who probably played every note percussively with no trouble. Sure. I know I'm not on the video. Maybe it's somewhere there's a video. Amazing. I don't go looking for videos of myself, to put it mildly.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
Let me intrude on my own interview and say, The glorious stuff that has showed up on YouTube of incredible bass players of every age and every gender and doing wonderful stuff. And I learned from that stuff in lockdown, a couple of years of lockdown and less work. I still had work, but less. I had the time to explore that stuff. And at first it was daunting. No, it was daunting from the first till the end. The technique and the ability of young players, especially young players. And I decided to treat it like they were teachers, like I was a student. I've done better. I got a better teacher in the Scots advanced bass technique. that's been an incredible journey that's not over of finding other bass players on the web that are doing stuff that is unimaginable when I was young and only imaginable now with a deep breath, taking a deep breath.
Well, I mean, you need to know that everybody at SBL knows the tale of you in lockdown, diving into the platform, taking maybe one or two of the accelerators or something and digging in. We're all like, you're kidding me.
Can I tell you an interesting situation? On tour with King Crimson, and I'm spending the afternoon backstage going, dun, one note, on lesson one or lesson two. And then I go on stage and play King Crimson, which has some pretty fast stuff. Next day, so it was great. I can't say that I finished it. That's still in my future. I got about halfway through, but the especially poignant was the weeks or month on the road when I was doing it every day, and then playing a show right after, a couple hours afterwards.
At this point in your career, what are you striving to get better at? What do you feel like you want to be working on?
Interesting question. Let me back up a little. In my opinion, there's room in music and musicians for guys my age who think, well, this is what I do, and that's what I do.
Yeah,
I think that's great. And there's room for people to try to learn and be better. There's a couple things about technique. The things that were being taught in that course, that didn't exist when I learned electric bass. I had studied classical before that, and I knew about that. And that technique and training has not changed. But there was no YouTube. There was no way to see how Jaco held his pinky with his right hand while he played. You'd have to go see the show. And you'd have to see every bass player. But there's also nobody as expert as you guys at trying to collate it. I think I heard Stanley Clark talking about trying to do that. And it was very hard. And then the timing was right and the people were right. So it's really changed the world of what it's like to be an electric bass player. And I know because I bridged the gap, maybe I didn't bridge the gap, but I go back to when, you know, the fastest bass players before Jaco. It was like, you know, year one kid without any, or not even year one. It just was a different world. And all of the techniques were unknown, except some for the guy who made up a new technique. Some guy would start slapping or something. So bravi to you all for that.
Oh.
And I'm glad to be around to experience that. And I'm glad that I decided during the lockdown to embrace it as a learning thing instead of just be puzzled about what the heck to do about it. I forget the last part of what you asked. I interrupted you.
I love it. Just what you're hoping to get better at. I mean, it's really inspiring to me that at this point in your career with all of this success that you still feel like you want to go and work on your craft. That's really inspirational. And I guess I just wonder what you want to be working on.
Well, thanks. I want to improve my playing. For me, my life, when I'm touring, which is fortunately often, this year is a very busy year for touring, making up the tours that were postponed from the last 2 years, right? I'm not the only one like that.
Right.
So I don't have time to work on, to do writing and to do, I didn't have time to keep up with the lessons, but I will go back. And by the way, I forgive myself for that. I know this is not quite about bass, but I couldn't keep up with the bass lessons. I put them aside. And I forgive myself for that. And I think that that's good practice for me at forgiving other people for maybe not being the best that they could be, the same as me. So I hope to get back to writing more material on the bass. I just contribute a lot to writing a Stickman album on the stick. But this is a year, this seems to be a year of playing, of doing what I most love and playing live. And I'm not going to come out of the year a whole lot better at technique, but there's next year.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I love that idea of being easy on yourself, giving yourself some forgiveness. I mean, we all suffered
I'm good
this
at.
Incredible. Yeah, that's good. Well, that's not a given. That's not a given for everyone.
In jazz, you know? I grew up with some players who just were great and just beat themselves up after every show.
Yes.
And I actually, after one show, I was a kid then. I was 19. And after the show, I said to the leader, trying to kind of surly trumpet player, I was a little behind the beat tonight. I wasn't good. He said, nobody gives a shit. He said to me, and I said, yeah, that's right. I guess I'll never do that again because nobody really cares to hear you whine about you didn't like your plan.
Yeah.
And that was the last that I did that.
Too much about you. Yes. I remember, you know, blowing something at a gig that my whole family was at and whining about it on the car ride home with my wife. And my wife said to me, you are making this whole night about you. And it wasn't about you. It was about everybody in that room that came to see a good time. Who cares? No one even noticed, you know, and that was a big lesson for me as well.
Interesting.
I love you talking about this idea, you know, that during the pandemic, you're diving into SBL, you're working on your craft, you're wanting to get better. And contrast that with this thing I heard you say. It might have even been in that same Bass Player magazine article, but it was somewhere where I think you said, I wonder if you remember this, that you would rather spend an afternoon with someone and teach them how to make a nice marinara for a bowl of pasta than to do a bass lesson. And I wonder where that comes from for you, or what's behind that statement for you.
I didn't remember that I had said that. It's pretty jive, but I'm writing it down, so I remember it after we're done. Marinara. Wow. Yeah, there's two things there. One is I'm not a teacher, never taught, I like to think that I'm open to the way players do things that are different than the way I do it. So I would hate to be the person to tell some young player, here's the way I've learned to do it. Largely because of that. And also I'm lucky to be busy playing and learning. And so I'm not a teacher. Yeah. So maybe that was in the back of my mind. But the other factor of that is rock players on the road. Must have been on the road with King Crimson, I'm guessing, because they line up interviews for you every day. And the nature sure. of interviews is it, unless you're Mother Teresa, you start to think that your views are important. Why? Because the person interviewing you is interested in you. And this is the extreme yes. of all time. You know more about me than I know about myself. but it's not real. Yeah. It's the rantings of, and I have said this in print, it's the rantings of tired old rockers who did three interviews before that same day. And we'll say just about sure. anything with the authority as if they really think it's meaningful. So that, to me, is pretty meaningless what I said about marinara. I can't even make a good marinara anymore. I'm not, I've been great. Married for 24 years and I haven't made sauce in all that time.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, you know, now I know you're a humble man. You have said even a couple times in this that you're not wanting to give advice or with the, maybe in the fear of saying, well, this is how you do it. And maybe sort of muting down someone else's view or ability, but you do need to know. And I think you do know that you have a perspective and voice. It of course isn't the only perspective and authority, but it is one of perspective and authority in and amongst some of the best people to ever do it. So I want you to, if you could say something to someone at the beginning of their career, just from your perspective, not from, you know, the all-time authority, but from you, that are trying to balance being a session musician and play for artists and for people while still simultaneously trying to cultivate their own artistic voice, which in the beginning, that's how I feel about your playing, is you have this sonic signature, you have this artistic voice, yet you always play so supportively for an artist, and that is a tightrope. It is absolutely a tightrope. And so for me and for people watching, there are going to be a lot of people watching this that just would love to know a bit of perspective from Tony Levin around, like, how do you think about that? What do you think is important to navigate that space?
You got me on the spot here. First of all, I don't think about that. But since you've asked, I'm trying to think about it. And I've already mentioned that I always go for supporting the music. Music is more important than my technique or whatever it is I've been working on, the overall music yes. that's being done. I think it's a good idea, maybe not at the beginning. At the beginning of your career, what I did, I learned from my older brothers, take all gigs, work with as many different things as you can, even if it sucks, because maybe the drummer will be good, and maybe he'll remember you the next year, and he'll get you on some other thing, and maybe you'll meet this guitar player that you work well with. So take a lot of gigs, especially if it's early in your career, and do your best with them. And I'm thinking back of early in my career, was a long time ago, so I remember a lot of gigs that weren't really very good, and I'm saying to take those gigs. But yes, because the drummer on the terrible gig I did in Rochester in 1967, the drummer was Steve Gadd. And if I could just only think about his part during the gig, I didn't, because it was a large band and a lot going on. That one band, I did many good gigs then in Rochester, but there's something to be learned. Not from every gig, but if I think it's a good idea to play with players who are better than you,
Yeah.
I did when I was in high school. It was a really good drummer, and I was like, wow. And by the way, when I was a kid, I was playing upright, and you never could hear the upright, so I could get away with anything because the drummer was playing really loud, and the sax player,
yeah, sure.
And I'm playing not even a good upright, a kind of quiet one. Taking every gig, play with better players if you get the chance. Don't take it personally if you get rejected. I hope you're lucky. I hope for your sake that you're lucky and never get rejected. That would be great. And what I said to Julie Slick, wonderful bass player with Adrian Belew and now doing solo. Yeah. I'm proud of myself that I said to her when I met her that it's great touring with Adrian, but maybe start writing some solo stuff or have other projects because just the nature, however good the musical situation you're in, I said to her, however good that is, it helps to have more options because things can happen. It's the music business. Some tour cannot happen. And you want to have as many of those as you can, especially early in your career. If you get lucky enough to get an established band, then you can ease up on that or not. He says, as King Crimson has just announced, we're not touring anymore. So even then, it's good to have some keep up your writing. And so I'm digging deep for some advice.
I love that.
It goes against my grain.
Well, you're so gracious with that advice. I appreciate you doing that. And I think that is something that side musicians don't think of. They think that the ultimate thing is landing the gig, land that sweet gig and then you're all set and then you're coasting, right? I mean, if you could only just play with, if you could only just tour with, but I really like this idea of, you need to also make some of your own music because it will give you business options. It will give you creative options, right? You'll start to be seen as an artist, not just maybe a side musician.
Yeah.
And that can open maybe more doors.
Yeah. You put it better than I did. I agree.
No.
Listen to him. Listen to him. He's got it right.
Tony, where can we, as a community, there are going to be a lot of people watching this. This is for our Summit Bass Space 2022. Where can people go to support you? Is there a website or is there something that you want to talk about to promote that you're coming up that's exciting to you?
I'm very lucky. And I want to mention that I just came from doing sessions with Peter Gabriel. And next year, I hear there'll be a tour. So I'm hoping
Unreal.
That I get to see a lot of you or we get to. We get to share a mutual space with really special music going on. And the music is special. We just about finished the album. I don't know anything about the album coming out, but that's thrilling to me. Yeah, I'm in the band, but I'm a fan. So Peter Gabriel being back for a pretty major tour. So I'm thrilled about that. Stickman is always touring, the three of us, and we'll come to your area, I hope. I have a website, tonylevin.com, which sort of says, I update it myself, so it sort of says what I'm doing and that. But I think a more valuable thing about that site, and I put a lot of effort into it, is that I keep a road diary when I'm on the road with photos and stories from backstage, and I do that every day. And I'm too busy with Levin Brothers and Stickman, small group, don't have enough hours, but I'll certainly be doing that with Peter Gabriel next year. So if nothing else, you want to tune in on that just to see what it's like behind stage. And I love, my favorite part of that is taking pictures of the audience because the audience is the internet. One of the things it gave us is the chance to share how amazing a big, an excited audience for the band on stage. You can see everything and all the angles and stuff, but you can't feel it the way we feel it on stage. And that's part of why we do it. It doesn't need to be a big audience, but the passion. And so I try to get photos of that. It's not easy. Fortunately, I can play with one hand and take a picture. And I do that a lot.
You can tap.
But I try to do that specifically so that I can whoop it up on the web. And that's a lot easier now than it used to be. I started doing it in the 90s when I had to get it. The film developed and I had to have it scanned and I had to put it up a picture this big. So I try and do that so I can share with the audience that was there how they looked to us and a sense of how it felt. So I want to share that with you guys. I have a Facebook that has my rantings once in a while about, usually talking about this tour is coming up, and usually it's a link to my site.
Oh, that's, I love the idea of providing that window into what it looks like to be on stage and looking out into the crowd. Yeah. That's a gift. That's a gift.
It was impossible. Along. It used to be impossible.
Yeah. Hey, man, thank you so much for being here. This was truly, this was really special for me. In fact, Nick, our producer, before this, he kept this a secret from me for a while and then revealed it recently. He said, you're going to get to talk to Tony Levin. And I died. So really, I'm such a fan. I've been following you for a very long time. So really a treat for me and a treat for everybody else to hear from you. So thanks so much, man, for sharing your perspective with us. Well, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate obviously being part of this and being on it and getting to say space three times. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I appreciate, I'm embarrassed by how much you know about my history, but that's okay. I forgive you for that, but I appreciate the expertise. You do a darn good job at interviewing, and I appreciate that. Those of us who do more interviews than they ought to appreciate when an interviewer really knows what he's talking about and asks poignant and useful questions. So thank you.
You can die a happy man. Thank you, Tony. All right, to everybody watching, thank you, and Base Space keeps rolling.